I think boxers always think it could only happen to someone else. I don't think it's going to happen to me. I'm fit, I'm strong, I'm okay. But they're not okay. Many of them are already on the pathway to problems. But that's the high-risk sport. I don't want to see anything changed, because you'll take away and put it underground.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
Today, you're going to hear from Dave Harris. Dave is a former amateur boxer, as well as having worked as a trainer, manager and promoter of boxers. He's founder of the British Boxing Hall of Fame and also founded the Ringside Trust, which is a charity aspiring to create a residential home for former boxers. And boxing seems particularly pertinent to the justice system, actually, because people often come with a history of having learned how to box as a way of coping with bullying. You often find that people have that in their histories in the justice system. I'm really delighted to have you along today, Dave, to talk about your work. Welcome.
Well, I'm pleased to be here, Naomi.
Very good to meet with you, Dave. So can we begin with you telling us something about your relationship to boxing and how you came to set up a charitable trust?
Right, well, I boxed as a 12-year-old, and I've been in boxing most of my life. I guess I first started to think about the problems that exist in boxing when I founded the British Boxing Hall of Fame back in 2015. And then started to meet a lot of the old ex-champions. One particularly was a guy called Johnny Clark, who was the former British bantamweight champion. He was undefeated when they took his license away, and he was also the European champion. He was in a home quite close to where I live, and we got quite close, and I used to visit him. I used to take him out and take him to ex-boxers meetings throughout the country. And he enjoyed those, and he used to come alive. Instead of just having a blank expression and going back to a home where nobody really understood what he had been or what a famous man he'd been. In fact, he boxed more times at the Albert Hall than any other professional boxer in history. So he'd always been a high flyer in boxing, really. When I first knew him was back in the 1970s. He was young, vibrant, full of life, handsome, and a great guy, really was a nice chap. As the years went by, obviously, different things happened in people's lives. When I met him again, I saw such a vast difference. And knowing that he was then in a home, used to go and talk to him about the old days. And strangely enough, with pugilistic dementia, quite often, they can remember bits of the past clearly, but very little about the future, about what he'd even done the day before. But he was lovely company, and I grew very fond of him. Got to know quite well his daughters. By that time, I thought, although we'd always heard about there was this need for a place for boxers, but oh, it had never happened. And that's been the attitude that I've faced right through to this very day. People in officialdom, and I guess from a promoter's point of view, I don't know whether you want me to go on to this now, but from a promoter's point of view, I think there may be an element of thinking they could get sued, although there is very little possibility, because boxing, you couldn't actually pin the problem down to any particular fight or training session or whatever. But they have been particularly quiet. They don't want to get involved in any way. The British Boxing Board of Control do a wonderful job in, since Michael Watson had his brain damage, they've really done a first class job. In fact, the British Boxing Board of Control probably lead the world in their care of boxers before contests and to some extent after contests. But it's not about them. It's about their future after their boxing careers have ended. And that's when the problems start to arise.
So you're saying really that the authorities didn't really want to recognise the problems in case it brought some sense of responsibility or blame with it?
I think you've hit the nail right on the head. Promoters have a very busy lifestyle. They work very hard for what they get. There's no doubt about that. But the sheer manner that, what boxing is, if you're building up a future champion, they've got to learn their business on the way up. And quite often, it's twofold, really. The journeymen on the way up often get damaged. The champions that reach the top, again, often get damaged. You've got former champions, and I think it's general knowledge now. Lloyd Hannigan, who was went to America and beat one of the pound-for-pound greatest of all time in Don Curry, he is in a home. He's in a wheelchair. And obviously with some mental health problems. That man, less than 30 years ago, was at the peak of his physical and mental capabilities. So that's... And of course, boxers... Sorry, I was just going to say, of course, boxers never think it's going to happen to them. They always think, I'm okay. Sadly, although they think they're okay, many are already not okay. And I have been around, as I said, since I've been 12 years old. I can look at boxers that are boxing today that will be in trouble in 10, 15 years' time. Without any shadow of a doubt.
Do you think you can see that coming then, Dave?
Yes. Yes, I think you can see it coming. I think when you're around boxers all the time, like I've spent my life around them, I can remember when I was quite young meeting former champions who slurred their words, ground their teeth, turned. There was little telltale signs of problems. And I got very close to a boxer back in the 30s called Nipper Pat Daly, who they took his license away, the board at the time, which was very new, having a British Boxing Board of Control in those days. They took his license away, saying... he'd been, by the way, a professional since he was about 12 years of age. I know this seems ridiculous, but he had. And by the time he was 14, he had done 15 three-minute rounds with the British bantamweight champion. It's unbelievable. At least it wouldn't happen today.
You're referring a lot. You've referred to dementia pugilistica and signs of neurological damage. What kind of age are the boxers when those sorts of signs are emerging? Are we talking about much older men? Are we talking about injuries that, that occur quite early on in life, really?
Right. There are a number of instances of men as young as their early 30s that are suffering with pugilistic dementia. There is a former world champion. I won't say his name because he's still a very young man. I think, you know, he's in his mid-30s. Wasn't very many years ago. He was a champion of the world. That man has mental health problems, and there's a number of them with mental health problems, that there doesn't seem to be anything, any structure within our sport to deal with it. And that's why over the past 4 years, I have worked and all the trustees that are with me and the ambassadors, and some of the ambassadors are really famous people. For example, I don't know whether you know much about boxing, but John Conte, Duke McKenzie, three-weight champion of the world. He's been brilliant. Absolutely. Both of those two have been brilliant. Also, John H. Stracy, that went to Mexico and took the title off Napoles, Jose Napoles. They work alongside many others. James Cook, who MBE, who does an amazing job in Hackney in London with the young people. He's another ambassador. These people are very caring and understand the high risk that boxers take.
So are these all involved with the Ringside Trust then, Dave?
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that then? How did you come to...
The Ringside Charitable Trust. Hmm. Well, after seeing so many boxers that were clearly having problems, I decided I couldn't let it carry on like it. Somebody at some time... And I've been hearing people saying this for the last 50 years. Nobody does anything about them. They're just on the scrap heap. You know, that's the end of them. And nothing's being done. Now, I thought, right, I'm in a position of at least some power with being the chairman of the British Boxing Hall of Fame, which is... grown very big. It's grown like Topsy, really. It's just become the biggest and most prestigious award in Britain for boxers. So that gave me the input to think to myself, right, do something about this. Matt Christie, who is the editor of Boxing News, who has been absolutely brilliant. He loves his boxing, as I do. We know it's high risk. There's no way around the fact if you take away boxing, which is legal and has all the correct medical connotations to it, if you took that away, it would go underground, as like white collar boxing has become. There are people being damaged weekly in white collar boxing, which is another thing that I'm campaigning to stop.
What is that, Dave?
White collar boxing. It's these people making a great deal of money. It hasn't got any official powers in any way. People promote a show. They put a show on. They sometimes have a doctor there on the night. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. People train for 6 weeks, pay something like £35 a session. Then they have to sell a table of 10, and then they get a trophy at the end of it. But they could be matched you could get a man off the street that said, right, I'm going to have a go. So they go for this 6 weeks training period. They then meet somebody who they don't know, who may be an experienced ex-boxer. There may be big weight differences and age differences. And a number of people have died in white collar boxing. It's unregulated. It shouldn't exist. And Ringside Charitable Trust are fast becoming the conscience of British boxing. And it's something I've never ever wanted to be. I've never wanted to have to put myself in a position where I've got to be the one to keep saying this is not right. And their trustees too. So Ringside Charitable Trust, really, to go back to your question, I'm sorry, I'm going around corners here.
Oh, it's great, Dave. Don't worry about that. It's really interesting what you're saying, yeah.
Right, Ringside Charitable Trust. Once we had got, and I found it very difficult to get charity status. Once we got charity status, it seemed to blossom. It blossomed with the hardcore boxing fan. The support we get is from the man in the street, the man that loves his boxing. We have little support, although, in fairness to the British Boxing Board of Control, they are in an invidious position. They're damned if they do and damned if they don't, really. They don't really want to, I can understand, acknowledge that there is a bigger problem than people think. There are literally hundreds, many we don't even know about, because boxers are proud people. And it won't be many years before it will be women, female boxers too. I mean, that could be in the same positions. So Ringside Charitable Trust have done everything in their power to promote the need for a home. As I said, Matt Christie has been brilliant. Matt Christie has got a lot of courage. As editor of Boxing News, he's also in a very difficult position. But he is very clear. There needs to be a home for boxers in need. And it needs to come soon. Now, we've had some luck just lately, as well as being able to speak to Naomi and yourself. We've also got on board a guy who works for one of the universities as a fundraiser, a professional fundraiser, who loves boxing. He's actually come on board as our unpaid advisor, which is wonderful. And he's obviously got tremendous contacts. So I think the home will happen in time, Dave, whether the board or the promoters really get behind us. Now, the board have acknowledged what we're trying to do and have been supportive by saying, we support you, but there's little we can do. Now, the board, in my opinion, who do a wonderful job, there's only eight of them. It's ridiculous that a sport that raises and can make millions upon millions of pounds, albeit only for perhaps 5% of all those that box, there are only eight professional workers that work in the board office. Now, I think it should be strengthened. I think the government should strengthen and give them more support than what they have. I'm not sure I answered your question.
I wondered why do you think that is? Because I think obviously you look at other sports where they've got much bigger teams overseeing what happens. Why do you think it is about boxing that might might play a role there?
I think boxing needs to come out of the dark ages. I think it needs to start realising there is a problem. There is a problem with former boxers. As Trish Dixon said in his book, he travelled the world speaking to so many world champions and their wives and their families. And one of the things that Trish made it clear was no one anywhere in the world wants to recognise there is a problem. And in 1937, I know it's going back 80 odd years now, maybe a bit longer, there was a Professor Roker, I think his name was. I think he was in a very similar business to you. His knowledge was, I'm not sure whether, he might have been in psychology. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been, yeah. So you would have probably got on well with this chap. He really did do his bit. He tried to get a home for boxers that were suffering from pugilistic dementia or domestic pugilistica, however, which way round. He tried his best, and all he was met with was a little bit like we've been met with, closed doors, silence, don't want to discuss it, don't want to talk about it, we're not going to get involved. That is the attitude. And in the end, he gave up. Well, I'm not prepared to give up.
It's interesting because you've obviously got great promotional skills. The fact that you have managed to create this British Boxing Hall of Fame, which, as you said, has grown like Topsy, and you're presumably using the same kind of skills, but whilst it's flourishing more recently, it's still requiring quite a lot of work to get it to the point where you'd like it to be.
Well, fortunately, in my work, I was a principal officer in social services. I've done social work, I've done, you know, went through all the levels. And the one thing that I did get a good understanding was, and I had supervised running homes. So I have a good understanding of the costs. I have friends still in social work departments. I must bring it with me on the day to show you. But in fact, to actually set up, once it's paid for, the home, to actually the running costs for a year for a 36-bedded unit come to approximately 1.2 million. It's around about that figure. And that's with having a doctor available at all times. It's having three sisters. It's having I haven't got it in front of me, the paper now. It's having, I think, about 10 care workers. It covers everything right the way through to the gardener handyman, to covers every aspect of running a home. Mostly that will be paid for by the different local authorities that these people come from. So in fact, although it's costing 1.2 million a year to run, if the home was full, which we would anticipate that it would be, although so many places would have to be for respite care. So it's about not only having the long-term residents, but being able to work with people to get them back home, get them back in the communities. So for 1.2 million a year, we could, in fact, if we were full, clear that and a little bit more with the money that comes in. So, in fact, we would still continue to do all the things to raise money, because my dream would be, and I don't think I'll be around to see it personally, because obviously age is against me, but I would love to see a home up north. I would like to see one down south or in the Midlands, and perhaps one near Wales. And I have to say, the Welsh boxing fraternity have been brilliant, absolutely first class. They're always doing things to raise money for Ringside Charitable Trust, as many of the ex-boxing associations do. So we've got some strong supporters, but it is the main players. Although I will say, with this national press conference coming up, we have already had one reply from one of the new kids on the block, who is the new guy dealing with Sky Television boxing. And he has said that he will be there and has asked for a ticket to attend. So perhaps there's changes on the way. Perhaps he's going to show the others up, really, by saying, yes, well, okay, there's a problem. They're not trying to ban boxing. What they want to do is just to ensure they're looked after, those that fall through the net.
It's good to hear you describing your ambition there, Dave, because I was thinking as you were talking, really, you do need more than one home from the size of the problem you've been describing. And it is, I think, shocking. I was going to say surprising, but actually it's shocking that there isn't already some provision. If you think, because I know that Equity has a number of provisions for former actors and entertainers, so for boxing to have nothing is really rather scandalous. And I was also thinking, let me get this out, I bet the MCC has more than 8 members of staff on its
body.
Now
I'm going to tell you something now. I have a meeting coming up within the next 2 weeks with, and they've come to me. I haven't gone to them. They're asking to meet with me. This is the cricket board, people from the cricket board, who I think are looking to improve on their care of cricketers that are, pardon the pun, fallen through the net. So so there's all sorts of things on the horizon. And the other thing I was going to say to you is, you're so correct in the fact that Equity, Brinsworth House, which is the actor's home in North London. I have to say, when I first was starting up the idea, they were so supportive. They gave me as much information that I required, and they were very helpful. And I would like to think that we could even have evenings together where we took some of our more able residents from the boxing home to Brinsworth House, where they could perhaps listen to the singing and the dancing, or the whoever the artists that are in Brinsworth House now. Perhaps we could do something together. This is the dream, but it's more than a dream now. We're moving forward at quite a rate.
That would make a great documentary. Actually, you can just envisage it, a group of your famous former boxers visiting an Equity home and engaging with them there. It would be fantastic. Yes. Do you think, Dave, that anything needs to be done to make boxing safer?
I think after Michael Watson's injury, I think both the amateur, in fairness to both amateur boxing, but particularly with professional boxing, we probably lead the world with their care of boxers when they're having their medicals to box. They have, it costs, obviously, the promoters and the board considerable amounts of money to have doctors. Well, they've always had doctors in attendance from donkeys years ago when I first went into professional boxing. But they have all the right equipment. They have checks, they have neurological, MRI scans. They do everything within their power to check that, and many boxers are turned down from boxing. So I give a great deal of credit to what the Border Control are doing, albeit I think they should be given a lot more support, really, by the government to give them more strength, more power, because they're in a position, really, they haven't got a great deal of power. As I said, they run sometimes up to 40 shows in a month. Well, that takes one heck of a lot of organising, remembering that you've got to have all the appropriate people in place, the judges, the referees, the medical assistants, the doctors, the whoever is involved. They probably would say they're okay, but I think it could be, my own opinion is, if they were stronger and had more financial clout, they could also be far more involved with helping in the aftercare of boxers. And I think, particularly in amateur boxing, one of my real beefs, and it is a something that needs to be addressed. The people that run amateur boxing, I don't know the financial situations, but year upon year, they put the prices up to be affiliated, for amateur clubs to be affiliated. And an average club has to pay between £800 and £1,000 to this organisation, which is England Boxing. They have to pay this money to them to be associated. Not only that, then they have to pay, as we did in the old days, the areas like the southern counties, northern counties, and that's probably another £400 or £500. Well, there are amateur clubs going to the wall every week. I know this isn't anything to do about neurological problems, but it does mean that young people are not learning discipline and camaraderie. Boxing has lots of good points to it. It develops discipline. It develops, it takes away the bullying, because everybody knows there's always going to be someone else that's stronger or better than you. I'm going off the subject a bit, and I'm sorry, but it's one I do think is another problem that boxing's got that needs addressing.
Because in a way, one imagines that amateur boxing might be even more tightly regulated. But I mean, just to think about the issue of money, because one tends to think that there is a lot of money in boxing, and perhaps there is at some level. But why do you think that the boxing associations are so starved of cash in that case?
In when it comes down to professional boxing, there is only about 3% of all the boxers. I think there's just over 1,000 boxers in this country, to my knowledge, professional boxers, and only about 3 to 5% earn enough to do it as a full-time living. Probably out that 5 or 6%, there would be 3% that earn astronomical figures, millions and millions. I mean, I think it's a bit pie in the sky, but I heard that Tyson Fury, and it's quite interesting, in boxing news this week, somebody, in the letter to the editor, somebody had written, "What a crazy world we live in," when Tyson Fury has just said, "I want £500 million if I'm going to fight again," where Dave Harris is struggling to get the money to open a home for those in desperate need within the support. What a crazy world we live in. And that was the I think, one of the letters of the week. So it's quite interesting that even the boxers who raised money for they're raising money for all sorts of different charities, but never for the one charity that is available to help their own people. And I think that's been said by Matt Christie in an article the other week. He finds it absolutely ridiculous that for some reason, who is stopping them from doing this? Is there someone saying, don't get involved, don't get involved? Possibly, I don't know. It's just reading between the lines.
Well, it's, I suppose it's easy to see why promoters might not want to talk about some of the risks and might not want to dwell on poor outcomes for people. But I wonder whether there's something in the character of people who go into boxing whereby they might avoid thinking about things that are unpleasant. Because in a way, boxing is a strategy. You know, you're fighting back, aren't you? So it's about not acknowledging vulnerability. And I wonder whether it's easier to look over there at something else rather than to look inward into the sport, and which could potentially make them feel more vulnerable, couldn't it?
I think boxers always think it could only happen to someone else. I don't think it's going to happen to me. I'm fit, I'm strong, yeah. I'm okay. But they're not okay. Many of them are already on the pathway to problems. But that's the high-risk sport. I don't want to see anything changed, because you'll take away and put it underground. Boxing does not need to go underground. It's got enough problems, particularly when it has got a border control that are doing their level best. You've got the amateur side of it that I think runs very well with their medical setup and assessments. Although I do think they charge far too much money, and that's why so many clubs have gone to the wall. That needs to be addressed. They get money from the government, the amateur side. Well, they need to address the problem, and the government need to understand there is a problem. The one thing they don't want to do is see clubs close, which is, in this day and age, the one thing that gives discipline. And because of it's a macho sport, or seen as a macho sport, a lot of young people will go into boxing rather than drift into crime. And that is a godsend, because once they get into boxing, they learn the discipline, they learn camaraderie, they learn all the good aspects of becoming. And I've seen so many ex-boxers become such outstanding role models and lovely people. I have to say, the boxing world is full of the most gentle. This is a strange thing. Ex-fighters, most of them are very gentle people that wouldn't go looking to cause any problem to anybody, and they would walk away rather than get involved. But I said, we do have a problem, Naomi, as you understand. I mean, you see it a lot more than I do. So it's about our sport waking up and saying, yes, there is a problem. We will deal with it, and we will help those that want to deal with it, so that these people are looked after. So those that fall through the net are in fact forever going to be looked after for the rest of their lives.
I can hear you talking, Dave, about some of the positives that people get from, and I know that there are specialist projects that work with young people at risk of becoming criminalised by getting them involved in boxing, and through that discipline enabling them to stay out of contact with the criminal justice system. So that's obviously some of the good work that happens. But I know from Chris Dixon's book Damage, he estimates that possibly as much as 85% of boxers, and I'm going to struggle with this word now, so the experience chronic traumatic, is it cephalopathy.
CTE,
yeah. We'll call it from here on
that's
in.
That's the easiest way of saying it.
I think, yeah, but boxing isn't the only sport that's facing concerns about CTE, is it? So I know that there's been real concern in American football. It's also increasingly spoken about in rugby and soccer. I read a recent interview with Carl Heyman in The Guardian, who was discussing his early onset dementia and attributing that to playing rugby. So, you know, it sounds like boxing's lagging behind some of these sports in a way, in terms of acknowledging the problem and trying to do something about it.
They are lagging so far behind. Rugby acknowledges a problem. Football now, through Jeff Astle, whose family brought it all to light, football now is addressing the problem. Cricket, strangely enough, also, I mean, people get hit with cricket balls and all sorts of strange happenings in cricket. They've addressed that they've got a problem with ex-athletes. And boxing doesn't want to or doesn't know how to. All I've ever asked them is, I have the knowledge to set a home up. Very few people do have that knowledge that are actually in the world of boxing. But I'm blessed with the fact that I have that in my past, the knowledge to do this. All I need is for the promoters in this country, who I have contacted every major promoter. It's been in all the boxing magazines. All I would like is for them to put a pound on a ticket. Now, if you think that Tyson Fury boxed in London the other week in front of 94,000 people, if everybody had paid an extra pound, that would have given us £94,000 towards this home becoming a reality. Now, we've had people climbing mountains, doing marathons, young people from a boxing club picking up plastic off of beaches, men of 90 walking, a group of them walked to the end of South End Pier and back, all in their 80s and 90s to raise money for ringside, all with their t-shirts on, you know, and it's awe-inspiring, really, that there are these people that will do this, and so many other things. It's like on Saturday, there's a number of us going to walk over hot coals over in Portsmouth. I'm not looking forward to it because I've got very tender feet, but there's
all in the mind.
Sorry,
it's all in the mind.
Yes, well, that's what I'm going to have to. That's where I'm going to have to focus on it. Yeah, no pain.
That's not an easy challenge.
But there's 80 people doing it, and we're hoping it raises quite a lot of money. But there is an apathy. There's an apathy, apart from the hardcore boxing fan that has given us so much support, there are many people that just say, it'll never happen. It's so easy to say something won't happen. So we won't support it because it won't happen. I've even had people say, how do we know it's not a con? You know, it's a charity. It is an established, regulated charity where every penny goes into the charity, apart from buying T-shirts and caps and whatever the trustees decide to get, badges and things, which are all sold. No other money is spent. If the trustees have meetings, we all pay for those meetings to go wherever we go to them, for the food, petrol, whatever. Nothing comes out of the charity. We all pay it ourselves, because no one can then point a finger, because we've got to be really perfect in what we do.
And Dave, CT isn't the only risk that former boxers face, is it? Because I think we increasingly see that elite athletes struggle to cope with transitions such as selection and deselection. So could you talk us through some of the other problems, the other kind of like mental health problems that might arise for boxers? Right.
When boxers retire, remembering, and I remember it happened to Frank Bruno, all the time he was in full-time training, going to the gym, doing his runs, going back home, relaxing, etc., etc., keeping busy. When he retired, like many of these boxers, there is nothing. Some of them can take up hobbies like golf and go into business, but there are at least 50%. Maybe more than 50%. I haven't got the figures, but many of them drift into gambling. They drift into drink, which seems to be their answer to everything. And of course, if they're well known, there's so many backslappers that will say, "Oh, could you come on out, have a drink with me," and down the slippery slope. You know, it's you're right. There is a real problem regarding retirement of all athletes. And it's something that, again, needs to be looked at closely and addressed, because there's so much sadness. It's not just for them, it's their families. They go home drunk. We've got knowledge of some of our ex-boxers, one quite a young chap still, that can't live at home. His marriage is split up with a young child of a, you know, very young age. He can't cope. He's not coping. He's not in the situation where they're going to take him into the care situation. So he sleeps rough. He's out on the street sleeping rough. Now, if this home was open, because we would take him in, we would sort him out, we would make sure that we could address it with appropriate counselling, and perhaps look to see how we, when he goes back home, how that we can support him. Because boxing, we have a good network. We set up a care line with, I've got four wonderful ex-boxers who all man it one day a week. In fact, one does 2 days a week, where they're on call. And quite often, it's not the boxers that phone in, it's their partners or wives to say, "I can't carry on anymore. He's losing his temper, he's hitting me." Some of them are in the early stages of pugilistic dementia, or CTE, they are calling for help. All we can do, which I've made it very clear, and I'll bring some forms when I see you next, and you can see that we don't try to counsel people, because these guys aren't trained counsellors, but they are very caring, and they will put people onto the appropriate, whether it's counselling or whether it's housing or whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous. They will give them, and they will always be there to talk to them. And that's all we can offer at the moment. I hope that when the home is open, that we can run this service from the home, from one of the offices within the home. Sorry, have I gone off the subject?
No, not at all, David. I was thinking as you were talking that one other figures that I was quite shocked by is it seems to be associated, but previously boxing seems to be associated with very high levels of suicide and also murder quite often of partners. And I wondered, do you think that's attributable to the sport, or do you think that's more likely to be a consequence of the kind of backgrounds people had before they went into the sport?
Bit of both, I think, Naomi. I think a bit of both, because I think to say that one thing causes the problem. I think yes, there's a lot of deprivation. And boxers come from deprived areas quite often. Not always. I mean, every now and again you hear of people coming from, I'll give you an example, Muhammad Ali come from a very middle-class family, own their own home, plenty of money coming in.
Didn't you say one of the cabinet was a former boxer as well?
Sorry?
Didn't you tell me one of the cabinet was a boxer?
Yes, yeah. Dominic Raab boxed for, I think, Foley Amateur Boxing Club, I was told, and also was an Oxford Blue. So I've invited him to our press conference. I've also invited, although I think there's a new Minister of Sport, and I don't know who he or she is at the moment, because the other one resigned not very long ago. I'm hoping that they, if they don't come, and I doubt whether they will, but I'm hoping they will send appropriate representatives who are going to listen to what's said that day. Because I really do think I've called it the conscience of boxing, the day. And it's a conscience that the governments need to address the many different problems, particularly white collar boxing, where people are dying regularly through being inappropriately matched, without the appropriate training. 6 weeks being trained by a coach that may be a good coach, may not be. But the damage that's being caused, it's got to be outlawed and put under, if they want to do white collar boxing, it's got to come under one of the auspices of the Amateur Boxing Associations rather than Border Control, because I don't think the Border Control is in any position to take on more than what they've got. I mean, boxing is booming at the moment with the great champions that there are around. But that's a problem in itself that needs addressing, really.
I was thinking, yeah, that's certainly a very interesting area, the white collar boxing. But putting it to one side for a moment, Dave, do you think class and poverty play any role in why boxers are so unsupported when they retire?
I'm not sure that... I don't think that is the answer. I think probably there is an element of some boxers coming from a poor background, and perhaps there isn't the support around when they go back into that arena. I think there's, as Naomi put, there's two different sides to the question, really, in this. But boxers, I think there is a real problem in retirement, and how we address it, I think, is about whether it's rugby, boxing, cricket, whatever the sport happens to be, there's got to be some support mechanism for when people leave their sport. Because athletes all of a sudden find they've got time on their hands, and some of them need direction, really. Some are very bright people. I don't think it's just about, there are some that are not very bright too, that will fall by the wayside. But I think it's about really a safety net for all sports. When boxers, rugby players, footballers retire, there should be somewhere where they can go to say, right, now, what are you going to do? Somebody should be addressing it, saying, have you interested in opening your own business now? Because you can't just sit back and do nothing. But there's nobody to make these statements to them. And I don't know the answer. Perhaps it should be something that all sports need to look at how they can address it. I mean, I've got the biggest problem thinking about the ones that are falling through the net and will not find a support network because of the damage that's been done to them. So I don't tend to have answers for everything, Dave. I haven't. I wish I had.
But it does sound to me, at any rate, that you're the seed to help develop and grow this larger welfare movement that's clearly needed.
You're clearly really passionate about the sport, Dave, and also do carry a sense of responsibility for what happens. But I suppose we can also hear you quite realistic about the long-term consequences, which could feel a bit depressing at times, I guess, in terms of a bit like Sisyphus trying to push that rock up the hill. How have you maintained your own sense of hope and positivity?
I don't think I'm always as strong as I'd like to be. I think what carries me through is that people have an expectation that it's a bit like the song that sometime that you hear it, or you can get it on Amazon, Never Give Up, Never Give In by the Fighting Legends. I think that's what I hold on to. You know, I can't give up and I can't give in till we achieve this aim, because it is so needed. And I think there's so many people, particularly boxers in need. And I think about the people like Bunny Sterling, that was the former British and European middleweight champion, middleweight champion, I think he was. His daughter told me when we was at Abbey Road Studios, when we were recording this song, she was actually working there, and she actually said to me, she said, "My dad," she said, "I am so pleased you're doing something about it. My dad, I tried 40 homes. He had pugilistic dementia and nobody would help. No one gave me any help. I went to 40 care homes and not one would take him because he'd been a professional boxer." Now, Bunny Sterling was a very gentle character. Okay, we all know that part of the problem can be that with CTE, that they can have temper tantrums and really go into one. But she was telling me that at last she got a home to take him. 3 weeks before he died, it was in a home where nobody knew who he was. So in his dementia, there was no one there to say, "Hello, Bunny. Oh, I remember when you boxed so-and-so." Because sometimes there are the seeds that come back into their head to remember they were somebody that, yes, little bits from the past, which I saw in boxers that I have known with dementia, that their eyes light up. They actually say, "Yeah, I remember that." Well, he tore a lump out of his head where she'd taken a picture of it. One of the most horrific things that I'd seen. He had pulled the skin, the hair, he had ripped. He was in such frustration that you could see right through to the skull. And she was so supportive and saying, "Please, it'd be lovely if that home becomes reality, because it would mean my dad didn't die in vain." You know, and it's, I guess that, yeah, it makes me emotional because I think about these people and I think we won't leave a stone unturned. We will need to continue the fight and continue to try and get more and more people involved. Hopefully with this guy from the university with tremendous contacts who loves boxing and is a a really lovely man. I'm hoping he's going to be able to make it, although he's later that day, he's got to fly off to Asia, but he's trying to put his flight back so that he can be there on the day to hear you speak and the others, Trish and a few others.
I suppose what I took from you talking there, Dave, is what keeps you going is, I think, kind of a sense of activism, you know, firing your energy into activism. And also I hear a lot of kind of like loving compassion, you know, a lot of love for the sport, but also love for people and wanting to reciprocate from some of the pleasure that you've perhaps had out of them, out of the sport. And if anyone wants to get involved to help with the work you're doing for the Ringside Charitable Trust, is there anything that they can get involved with?
They can, if they can come up with ideas, just like the guy that come up with the idea, Andrew Fairley, his name. He's come up with this walking across these hot coals. The first thing he did was have people jump in at ex-professional boxers. They weren't all ex, there were some current professional boxers, jumped out of a plane 3 miles up. If people can come up with an idea like that, or any idea which can raise money for the charity, we will give them all our support and any help that we can give them. We will turn up, we will, we've got a hardcore support band now, really. And I was just gonna say, there's a young lass, when you do things like this, it's amazing how people get on board. There's a young lass that has an immune system problem. And sometimes she's very ill and can't walk, but in other times she'll try and walk a mile or 2 miles a day in her back garden or around her house with a pedometer. She is walking from John O'Groats to Land's End. She's halfway there. There's been where she's had to have a week or so off at times when her health hasn't been good. But this is good therapeutic help for them as well. And when people try and do good, it's amazing how people get behind them to support them. So I'll be grateful for any support, Naomi, that we can get, because we will just keep on coming up with ideas, doing things. We had a skip into spring. The home will happen. I just hope it I really do hope it happens in my lifetime. I mean, it's at my age, I would have hoped it would have been. We're getting some younger people on board now that will carry the torch on. But I would like it to happen in my time, because I have that expertise to be able to ensure how the home is set up and run appropriately.
Good to see that, but it's been lovely to talk to you today, Dave. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about your work.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome.
That's brilliant, Dave. Really good to meet you.
Lovely to see you both.
I wish you all the well for the future with this plan.
Thanks, David.